This morning we hear quite a fantastic story, and hopefully as we're getting conditioned, when somebody in the Bible goes up the mountain, something's going to go down, and we have a rather interesting contest before us today. So the setting is this: we are in the northern kingdom of Israel, and this is Ahab, the seventh king of the northern king. Remember last week we talked that the unified kingdom had been divided, Israel to the north, Judah to the south. It's more, the kings have not followed the ways of God. They have become like the Egypt from which God freed them. There's oppression, there is doing the wrong thing. I'm trying to think of the word there. They're not doing what God has called them to do, what God has instructed them to do according to the law. They've been behaving like Egypt, and they've been following the ways of other gods, especially Ahab. Begun to listen to advice from the Phoenician gods, the Canaanite gods. Indeed, his wife Jezebel has brought into the household this other understanding of who God is. There's a lot of stories that build up the reputation of Elijah, one of the great prophets of old. Matter of fact, the hymn we just sang is the transfiguration scene. We're reminded that Jesus, when he appeared, had Moses and Elijah. I kind of joke, Elijah's the greatest prophet to not have his own book named after him. The idea was the king was charged with helping the people keep the law of God. And then the prophet was responsible for keeping the king accountable to the law. And Elijah's trying to do just that. In the scene we have today, he's trying to show King Ahab, and of course, all who are in attendance, that there is but one God, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, the God that freed them from Egypt. And so there's this wonderful scene that goes on. There's the lonely Elijah figure, and then there's 450 prophets on the other side. Elijah lets them go first, so they do their thing, and they're dancing and everything, calling on the name of Baal, and then they stop to listen. And I think if the Bible had a soundtrack or sound effects, you'd hear crickets at that moment. Nothing. And then it's Elijah's turn. He's going to call down fire from the God of Israel. And I'm reminded of those knife ads, right, where the pitch man would really work up how wonderful these knives were. And he'd take like a knife, and I don't know if you remember the one where he cuts the tin can with it, right, which would dull any knife. And then he cuts the tomato in this perfect thin slice. I think that's what Elijah is doing. He's overdoing it to show that the God of Israel can do anything. He's calling down fire, yet he drowns the altar and the offering with water. So indeed, God acts. God sends fire, but the fire, of course, is a testimony. The God of Israel who acts. We hear this story on All Saints' Day. It has its own interesting story behind it. Traditionally, the commemoration of the martyrs, this is the early part of the church, would take place on the anniversary of their deaths. However, for many whose death dates were not known, they had a commemoration for all the martyrs. And again, this is very early in the church. We're talking about 4th century AD. So those that they knew the death, they would commemorate. Those that they didn't, kind of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, I guess. This is the celebration of the unknown date of the death of the martyrs. And by the 7th century in the church, the feast had begun to include non-martyrs as well. So that is, any of the faithful who passed away. You know, a memorial service for all those who had gone before. The date of the festival varied depending where you were, in Europe or Asia. But by the 9th century in the church, Gregory the Fourth, the Pope declared the date set November 1st to be All Saints' Day. An interesting note, the reason it was set in that time, or in this time of the year, is because in Rome, where many people came for the pilgrimage, it was after the harvest, so there would be sufficient stores to feed the pilgrims as they came. Now, by the time of the Reformation, All Saints' Day had become the best attended service all year, including Christmas and Easter. All Saints was the best attended Sunday of the year, and that's why Martin Luther chose to post the 95 theses the day before, because he would have the biggest attendance of the church, and more people would be open to it and read it. So All Saints Sunday. All Saints Sunday, we raise up, of course. We remember those who, I joke, are in the Hall of Fame. The biggies, St. Patrick, St. Valentine, right? They have their own date on the calendar. Even us Protestants know their saint days. But All Saints Day, of course, is also remembering all those faithful who have gone before us. Thus, our slips of paper memorialize those whom we've loved and have joined the church triumphant. But All Saints Day is also our day. It is a day to remember that we too, by virtue of our baptism, are saints. We are the saints of God. Surely, along with those who have made the Hall of Fame, those who have passed that we remember, we too are saints. We have that last petition every time in our prayers. Every week we think of the saints and we ask that their example might be for us, that we too might live a faithful life. So we have this wonderful story of Elijah where God acts. And we have the story of All Saints Day where we say God has acted on the saints' behalf. By virtue of God's gift of grace, we remember those whom we consider saints. Now, as I shared when we were talking about starting the narrative lectionary, it's interesting. I don't know how to say, not a puzzle. I don't want to reduce it to that. But we have this text that was chosen kind of unaware what Sunday it would be preached. Where's the connection between the text and All Saints Sunday? And I think this one could be understood as pretty glaring. The story is ultimately about who is God. Is it the God of Israel? Or is it the God of Cana? Is it Yahweh or is it Baal? And in no uncertain terms, the story says that the one true God is the God of Israel, is Yahweh. But as we've been talking about since the story of creation, the Bible isn't just a book to prove God exists, but it's a book that says this is who God is, this is how God behaves. God acts, God intercedes in our text today. So where is the connection? I think the connection is this. We do not have an idea of some pantheon, right? This collection of gods, like we learn from the ancient Romans and the ancient Greeks and indeed the ancient Canaanites and the ancient Phoenicians. They had a pantheon of gods. So that's not our temptation, to think that some other god is God. I think the temptation is to make ourselves a god, and I mean in this way. Notice the story. The prophets of Baal are doing all that they can to catch the attention of Baal, to goad this Baal into action, to somehow force Baal to act. I mean, that's the majority of their story. The majority of Elijah's story is different. His story is about the setup, about making this story fantastic. And when it comes to having God act, it's a simple prayer. Elijah lifts his voice, and God shows up. I think often we feel like we are the prophets, or we feel we need to be the prophets. We need to behave in such a way to goad God into action. That it's because of how we behave will dictate how God behaves. But that's not the gospel story. The gospel story is one where God acts and we react. God acts to save the people, to give the people the gifts of faith, the gifts of grace and mercy and love and forgiveness. And then we respond. We react. Where we live our lives with that understanding of who we are as God's beloved children, but we also behave that way towards others. Now, I say that this is our temptation, and I want to share a couple of things that kind of led me to this thought this morning. First is my all-time favorite show is The Twilight Zone, right? The 1959 to 64. And as much as I love Rod Serling and agree that he was just a wonderful writer, and the quality of the series and the cutting edge things that they did, a lot of the episodes drive me up a wall. Two of them that I watched relatively recently was about a U-boat captain who fires upon an innocent ship drowning civilians, and so he and his crew are doomed to relive that night every night, right? To relive that scene every night. And it just plays into our fear of being banished to some kind of hell. Then there was another one about this neighborhood sidewalk pitchman, right? He'd go out with the suitcase that had the legs on it and set up shop, and he'd sell little knickknacks and toys for the kids. And he's just beloved in the neighborhood. Well, time comes, Mr. Death shows up. He's called and call him at midnight to die. And at the very end, the pitchman grabs his suitcase and says, "Who knows, somebody might need something up there?" And Mr. Death says, "Yes, up there. You've made it." All right, now these are just simple stories. These are just... But this is so much a part of what I think culture at large feels, and if we're honest, we feel. We have to behave in such a way throughout our lives to make it, to earn our way into heaven. Right? First, there's the cautionary tales. You don't want to behave in such a way that you're doomed to hell. You want to behave in such a way to make it. Now, on top of that, I know this is, you know, some time ago, the 60s, but, you know, Monica and I, we watched this comedian the other day, one of these Netflix specials. And you hear that language in comedy, too. You know, this guy's saying, oh, I believe in God, but I really don't go to church. Church is full of people, and this is the way he characterized us. We're thinking, you know, we're hoping we can get into heaven. And I've heard other comedians that talk about their understanding of who God is and what the church is, and like they found some loophole. Right? They don't need to be a part of the church because they understand, you know, you don't need the church to earn your way into heaven. All right, I keep banging the drum on this. Let me get to my point. I think that is the greatest temptation of idolatry. To believe that we somehow can behave in such a way to earn ourselves a spot in heaven. But that's not the story of the gospel. The story of the gospel says there's nothing we can do to earn it. If it's left to our own devices, we only thumb our nose and we behave the way we want. But we react so strongly to that. We feel like something that's given to us freely, well, surely that can't be true. And so we raise up our objections. But that means that there's some pretty bad people up there. Well, yeah. Or, well, that, but if we believe that, that means anybody can do anything they want. Well, yeah. But the minute we start to put constraints on who's in and who's out because of their own behavior, the whole gospel message is undergirded, undermined, destroyed. So this All Saints Day, we remember the stories of the saints. We hear today the story of Elijah, who drew people's attention to the God of Israel, the Lord, the God indeed. And we remember by virtue of our baptism that wonderful time where God acted for us on our behalf. There's nothing we did to earn that. God washed us free from sin, called us children of God, and guaranteed that we make it up there. Amen.